G'day, this is Tom Uren of Seriously Risky Business, and I'm here with the Gruck. G'day Gruck, how are you?
I'm excellent, how are you, sir?
Well, first of all, let me thank our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint, and also thank the Cyber Initiative at the Hewlett Foundation for their support. We were just talking about what it takes to be a cyber power, and we thought we'd today carve off the issue about harnessing talent by looking at some of the countries that we think may be cyber powers and look at the different way they've approached, I guess, talent identification and pumping people into a program.
Dan?
There's lots of different countries we can look at here. The ones that I think are interesting are kind of North Korea, China, Israel, the US, and they all do things slightly different. Where do you want to start, Gruck?
You know, we don't have a huge amount we can do on North Korea, so let's bang through that one quickly as one extreme and sort of move on westward.
Sure.
Okay. Obviously, the approach that North Korea has is they start them young, right? So they start in the schools and high schools, and they have a track for people that they've identified as like talented in computer, right? So they'll have, I guess they have some sort of skills or aptitudes test at some point, and they start going, all right, Kim over here is really knocking it out of the park. Let's put him in the cyber track. And you have your sort of life career specced out for you. You do your cyber track through high school. Then they have a sort of hacker college that you will go to. Then after that, you'll be into the intelligence services working on cyber. Maybe you get deployed overseas somewhere doing operational stuff. Maybe you're doing other things. But basically, you identify people with aptitude early on and then assign them to a career track, and then that's what they do.
Yeah, I guess that'd be the strong authoritarian model where it's talent identification and then kind of like a worker ant or a drone.
Right.
You're assigned a role and kind of that's it.
Right.
And that one of the things we were talking about is state intent. And for North Korea, we want a cyber program, so we need people, so we choose the people, and then we have people. Job done. I mean, there's a bit more to it than that, but if you need people, that's one way to get them, right?
Right.
So what's a good contrast?
So I don't know if it's a contrast, but I think there's more of a middle path with China, right? So I think we can draw a line at maybe 2015, 2016, which is when they changed their strategy and their approach. So first of all, in terms of state intent, they wanted a cyber program. Like that was a thing that they wanted, and they knew they needed cyber people for the starting phases because, here's my theory anyway, because it was mostly founded by hackers, you start the easiest way you can. You find people who are already good and you recruit them, and then they tell you how they got like that. And it's just like, we have no idea how hackers become hackers. It's like, it's some sort of miracle. Like one day you wake up.
I'm a unique snowflake.
Right. You wake up, you're like, I'm going to be a hacker, and you become a hacker, and that's all there is to it. And we have no idea how this magical process goes on. And so they were calling it a flower in a wheat field, this idea that there's these special things in a sea of nothingness. And so they try to find the flowers. So they're doing things like a lot of hacking competitions and sort of these CTFs and stuff like that to try and find people who had skills, and then they could recruit skilled people and put them into their training tracks to become government hackers. And then they changed their mind. And apparently this was from looking at the U.S. and deciding that the U.S. didn't do that, that the U.S. trained people. And so they decided they were going to train people now. So they went to some universities and they said, all right, like you guys are now cyber centers of excellence. You know, you're going to have master's degrees in cybersecurity. You're going to have a PhD in cybersecurity, and you're going to make cyber people come out of your process. And so they changed tack from we find people to we make people. And sort of that's been the approach that they've been doing. They've gone from, I think they started with 2, now they've got like 9 or something like that. It must be working for them, right? Based on if they're expanding it and they haven't reverted to their other approach, like clearly this is working for them. And it's different in the sense that I think people self-select into these things.
Uh-huh.
Like they're not going out and tapping people and being like, okay, you've got your life planned for you.
Here's your path in life.
Right. You know, congratulations.
Yep.
Yeah. So they sort of self-select, but I think when you've got like 1.3 billion people, you can do that.
Yep.
Your numbers are just so big that the law of large numbers means that if you only have people who've got talent and interest and they're the only ones who apply, you still end up with like a million people who want to do it.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Like
yep.
You.
Yeah. So Alex Joski, who researches Chinese intelligence services, just wrote a book about the MSS.
Uh-huh.
He was telling me that one of the first cybersecurity professors at a certain university was very senior in the MSS, the Ministry of State Security. His view is there's a deliberate, you know, we need it for intelligence, so that's why they're starting these programs, or that's why we started these programs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We were having this discussion about whether China, prior to becoming more professionalized, was actually a cyber power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it seems like the answer is yes, but not because they were particularly good or competent. It was just that they're risk tolerance was way higher than anyone else. And so they were effective despite not being particularly stealthy or competent or...
Yeah, so I don't think we should completely dismiss them because I think one of the...
No, I wouldn't dismiss them at all.
I mean, all they ever did was broke in and steal stuff and they did it everywhere. But, you know, I mean, the point is that they didn't break in particularly cleverly. So, I mean, does it really count? They did, so like, for example, the Lockheed hack was pre-professionalization. Like, I don't know whether it was done prior to them having the universities, but it was certainly done prior to the sort of the outcrop of the universities entering the workforce. It was still definitely the old force team. It was one of their elite sort of all hacker units that did that stuff. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, like they did RSA, like, what was it? They did like Bit9, then they did RSA, and then they did Lockheed. It was very methodical and well thought out and stuff. And the other one that was good was when they did the Operation Aurora, when they did Google, they used an IE ODE, and they didn't use like an IE6 ODE because that's what they had, but because that's what Google used in their corporate offices.
Right.
So there was some recon research.
Yeah. I think there's two points that I want to make there. One of them is that you can have a certain intellectual arrogance and say, oh, they weren't very good. Let's dismiss them. They were, and, you know, at the same time, they're stealing right. everything that's not nailed down. So I think it's silly to have that. And I don't have that approach at all. I'm just trying to sort of flesh out how they've matured. And the other point is that they have matured quite rapidly as well, right? Uh-huh. So that they've gone from, they're terribly effective but very noisy to, they've got the full spectrum. Sometimes they're still noisy and other times they're doing quite sophisticated stuff. And I guess the other point we should make about North Korea is that they also got a lot better relatively quickly as well.
They have improved dramatically, particularly if you look at things like early on, they were doing sort of not very impressive phishing stuff. They were using, you know, some of the same sort of really lame Trojans over and over again. It was like, it was not sophisticated. It felt very like a thing that works, even though it's embarrassing and you wouldn't really brag about it. Whereas these days they are developing ODEs. They are individually targeting security researchers to steal their ODE. They are doing very sophisticated attacks.
Yeah, I've got to say, if there's a state that I kind of admire for the way they do things, it's got to be North Korea, because some of the hacks they do are like beautiful puzzles that they've kind of constructed, where they link several different things that are related but are not necessarily on target. And the other great thing is that they mostly steal cryptocurrency, which feels like a victimless crime. I'll probably get hate mail for that, but
yeah.
And I mean, no, people do suffer, but
it's not ransomware at the kids' hospital, you know, unlike some nations.
But
they've got these sophisticated chained operations, which, you know, everyone does, but not everyone gets caught in every single step of the way afterwards.
But I mean, it's good enough to get the job done, right? Because you only need to steal $600 million from a crypto.
Right. Yeah. Well, once you've stolen the crypto, you don't need to go back. You don't need presence, right? You don't need to maintain access.
Yeah. And you can't steal it without getting caught.
Right. If it's gone, it's gone. But okay. So North Korea is the sort of authoritarian, how we pick you. Here's your life. China is a choose your own adventure, and
we'll provide a pathway.
Right. You know, pick a card, any card. All right. You know.
Yeah.
So Israel, I think, is another of the interesting ones in terms of the, you know, like once they leave 8200, they make a startup and they do more cyber.
Yeah.
I think that is, that's the life cycle of the Israeli hacker, as far as we know.
Yeah, there's a very strong culture there. So I wrote a paper contrasting Australia and Israel. I can't remember exactly what the topic was, but for the paper, I Googled unicorn, and if you Google unicorn in relation to Israel, you get billion-dollar cybersecurity companies. And if you Google unicorn in Australia, you get horses with rainbow-colored manes and horns on top.
You find out that unicorns are venomous and are known to kill at least 8 people a year. They are yet one other animal in Australia that wants to kill you.
But so I guess the Israeli model is they've got a pathway again. They've deliberately created a pathway that helps funnel people through their cyber military forces and then is still a state asset, I guess, going off to start companies afterwards.
It's a state-aligned asset, I think.
It's economically good.
Right, exactly. So I think one of the other interesting things is they're deliberate in their targeting, is that they're not just going out and being like, who is good with computer? Because, you know, that's going to get to people who have computers and time and, you know, a stable home life where you can mess around on the computer for hours, right? So they do go out and they try and get more women, and they try and get people from more underprivileged areas and things like that. So they're trying to get people who wouldn't necessarily go into that path by default anyway. And I think that's interesting. If in China it's finding people who have talent and interest, you've already filtered out anyone that would have interest and talent but not have the environment to develop
the means,
enough. Right. So I think Israel, but maybe to a degree that's a consequence of having 8 million instead of 1.3 billion. It's a scale issue at some point. You have to be more proactive. You can't just sit back and take the cream of the crop.
Yeah. So what I think is interesting about the three countries we've talked about is all of them feel that they're facing some sort of existential threat. So that's probably true for Israel, probably true for North Korea based on its own actions. And I think China manufactures that in the kind of Communist Party rhetoric is all about struggle and
I believe that's true. Like it's they all feel under threat, some of them for more valid reasons than others.
Yep.
And I think that what's interesting there is you end up with this clear state intent of like, we need cyber as a thing that's going to help us. And I want to sort of bring up Iran as a not necessarily a counterexample, but a an alternative here, where you again have that existential threat, that fear from the outside, plus clear state intent to have cyber as a thing. And so you would expect a similar approach, either the old Chinese one of, you know, a lot of CTFs, a lot of hackathons, a lot of state-sponsored, let's go out and find people who've got skills and then encourage them into the right career path. Or one of the other approaches of the, you know, here's a clear career track. You know, you start in high school, you do this, you get into university, you graduate, you work for 4 years over here. And as far as I know, and I did a little bit of research on this, apparently they don't have anything like that at all. The closest they have is because there's compulsory service, some of the companies that provide cyber capability, like these little Republican Guard or the Moise aligned companies, if you work for them, you don't have to do military service. So if you sort of have the skills an ability. You can not spend 2 years standing on the frontier holding a rifle. You can instead get a job and start working. So they have this waiver, which I guess does encourage people, but it's sort of very late in the process, right? If you're already capable of working for us, you can start working for us.
Yeah. That's not so much talent recruitment as avoiding talent loss.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I don't actually think of Iran as a cyberpower in the same way as all those other countries we've talked about.
I'm not sure Albania has that same point of view, you know. Iran is absolutely destroying NATO via just one, perhaps not the most robust member. But
I think they've got a way higher risk tolerance, right? And so that's the difference. Like, they've got the intent to do cyber things, and they've got the willingness to do it regardless, but they've just not bolstered it with an actual program to make it way better over time.
Right. One of the interesting things about Iran is, like, if you look at, you know, Lazarus, in 10 or 15 years, they've gone from, hello, I'm not a North Korean hacker, please click me, to RCE, O'Day, multiple chain countries, lots of things.
Yep.
All of these really complex and clever hacks. You know, like, they've clearly progressed up this skill path. But if you look at what Iran was doing 10 years ago and what they're doing today, it's like the same PHP scripts, right? Like, they haven't like, it's literally the same toolkits. Like, they haven't upgraded, they haven't tooled up, they haven't upskilled at all. And I'm quite curious. I'm sure someone's gonna show up and be like, well, actually, you know, they've changed ever so slightly in their skill level, but there hasn't been this dramatic increase that we see with other nations when they take it seriously.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, and my impression is exactly that mm-hmm. they've improved a bit, but the other nations, you can say there's sort of light years from where they were. So would you attribute that entirely to this sort of talent identification and training, or is it something else?
You know, I don't know what else it could be, because it seems to me that training is sort of how you get better, right? Like, you take in new people, you raise them up to the level that you're at, and then those people, when they're good, are going to sort of push it a bit higher. And then you have them train the next group. And it's sort of, you know, incrementally, you just have to get better. You have to improve. But if you don't really have a culture that does that, and saying culture in terms of, like, the state says, this is what we want to do, this is the approach that we're taking, everyone gets on board, or, you know, tough luck for you.
So then we get to the US, where I don't think there is anything like a talent identification program. And then you get intelligence agencies and the military trying to recruit people at the end of whatever school pathway that people feel like taking.
Right. And where they go out and they sort of, they get people after graduation saying, you know, hey, you're smart. You managed to pass a security background check and you're willing to wait 9 months while we get you your clearance.
Yep.
How would you like to work for NSA? I think that works as well, because here's the thing I think is very interesting, right? So Charlie Miller, for example, graduated with a math PhD and was not a computer guy. Like, as far as I know, like, he knew how to program a bit and whatever, but he was not a cybersecurity person. When he went in, they put him through their training program, and when he was out of that, he was doing exploits and hacking and all this stuff. So, like, they have this internal training program, but they don't have, I guess we could call it an external one. Like, they don't have the universities doing it for them. Instead, they take people who've got the aptitude and have demonstrated the skill and can pass the various hoops and hurdles, and then they go, all right, now we will train you.
Yeah. So Charlie Miller, who was NSA at some point, is that right?
Yeah.
And then he, most recently, he's been involved in a bit of car hacking. Is that the Charlie?
That's the Charlie, yeah.
Yeah, so in this case, we've got, on one hand, three countries, North Korea, China, Israel, who've got programs to funnel people to some degree, and they've improved rapidly, and I would call them all cyberpowers to various degrees. Then we've got the US, who's got the, maybe not the exact opposite approach, but it is also a cyber power. So how do we explain that?
So I think the US started out at the top and they sort of just stayed there in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, as we said last time, every time there's one of these assessments of who's the top cyber power, the US always wins.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, when I was first learning back in the late 90s, the guy who was mentoring me, he had been doing what used to be called Tiger Teams, which was the hacking stuff back then. And he'd been doing that, as far as I know, in like the 80s, security clearance type work. He said that like the office that he worked at, they had to put their hard drives in a safe every night.
Yep.
And this was back when you had like this lunchbox sized hard drive with 10 megs.
Yep. Yeah, Unix systems were always a lot better because they didn't have hard drives that you would remove.
Yeah. So, you know, if you take that at face value, which I'm willing to do, the US was doing hacking stuff as soon as hacking was possible. They have the Air Force security paper from like 76 or 79 or whenever it is, that's talking about the problem of buffer overflows and all of that stuff, you know. Yep. The Morris worm was written by the son of a guy who worked at NSA.
Yeah. You know? Yep. Yep. And if you think about the 1980s, the US was just technologically way more advanced than any of the other countries we've mentioned.
Yeah.
Did they even have computers back then?
Right. I mean, the internet was an American thing. Like, it didn't exist elsewhere. Like, it started in America.
So they just had a technological head start and they've maintained it. And I guess when it comes to intent, they do spend a lot on defense and the whole intelligence apparatus is relatively massive.
Okay, so we are between two nerds, the king of understatement. Okay, so, right, where's Australia? Because, you know, Australia didn't start out with the advantages that the US did. You know, like, Australia didn't start at the top, but I would say that they're, I don't know if cyber power is right, but they're not a cyber weakling, you know, like...
We always talk of ourselves as a middle power when it comes to international relations.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, no, they're not sort of on the beach and some other cyber powers come by and kick sand in their face. And
yeah.
They hold their own, right? I think, you know, when we were talking about how North Korea is doing these like multi-chained operations and stuff, that's not a thing that Australia can't do. You know, that's their bread and butter as well. But they don't steal crypto, so they're not that cool, right? They
Look, so I think my answer to that would be, it's in a way similar to the NSA answer, in that if you start with a professional organization that's taking these things seriously and doing them, I want to say properly, in the sense of like thinking through...
With purpose and intent, I think.
Yeah. Is sort of yep. And caring about OPSEC. I think OPSEC is, in a way, I think it forces you to think about things. It's a forcing function. That's the word I wanted to use.
Okay.
And it makes you think about all the different options and the parameters and implications. And I think that, in a way, levels you up because it forces you to do things that maybe you wouldn't want to do. And so...
Uh-huh.
And over time, you build tradecraft, right? And when new people come in, they absorb that tradecraft.
Right.
So you're starting sort of
at the top already, and then...
And I think it also pushes you to remain at the frontier because it's always a... I don't like the word arms race necessarily.
Things don't stand still, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Things don't stand still. So there's a new frontier of what is possible for both the the defender and the... attacker. And so I think maybe that's part of the answer for both NSA and Australia. And of course, Australia and the US have a very good intelligence relationship. So undoubtedly that has helped a lot as well. So I think they're those two dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure Australia would not be as competent without its relationship with NSA and the US. But I think that a lot of that is also driven by professionalism.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I was going to say, I think this might be a bit of a stretch, but one of the ways we could look at this as well is intelligence lineages, right? So on the Western side, you sort of have like the SIS, you know, like the British Secret Service approach, then the US with the OSS and their, you know, like the SIGINT services and stuff like that, where there's sort of one approach to doing things. And on the communist side, where you were having, you know, the KGB and the GRU, they have another approach to doing things, you know, like they've got different organizational priorities and cultures. And so if you are building your cyber intelligence apparatus from people who were trained by the GRU and the KGB, and that's the view that they have, they're going to maybe be very subtle about some things and not care so much about other things in the way. So, for example, in the, I believe it was the 1920s, when the Russians were very concerned about the Russian emigres in Paris, one of the things that they did was they kidnapped a general off the Parisian streets, took him back to Russia and disappeared him. And even though that was a secret operation, they didn't want it to be like secret.
the kind of secret where everyone knows.
Yeah. I mean, the point is we did it, but you can't prove we did it and we won't say we did it, you know?
Yep.
And I think that lineage might have some, I don't know how to put it, like a flavor, like an approach that you will develop over time that is different from where the US just sort of doesn't do that sort of thing. The UK doesn't do that sort of thing. It's not in their DNA. So when they're developing their cyber stuff, they're copying from how they would approach other operations, and it sort of trickles down. I know that we definitely see that with the way that the GRU operates in cyber, right? They very much copy the way that they operate in the real world, which is basically smash and grab. You know, they are not as concerned about OPSEC. They don't take it as seriously. They're much more results driven.
Yep.
And I don't know if it explains anything. It's at least an interesting thought experiment to follow through.
Yep. So it seems like we've decided that when it comes to getting good or being a cyberpower, intent and talent recruitment and identification makes a huge difference.
That's a critical element, but I don't think it's the only element. So there might be something else, which I guess we should talk about next time. The magic ingredient.
Yeah, we're saving the magic ingredient for part two. Thanks a lot, Grant.
Good talking to you.